Well, good morning and welcome to our in-person arguments this morning. I do want to make one comment before you begin, and that is, if you would please pronounce your name and your client's name for us just so we know that we're getting it correct, and also if there's any additional information that you'd like to provide about how to refer to you and your client, you can do that as well. And is it Cashins? Cashins?
It's Cashins.
Okay.
Your Honor, John Cashins on behalf of appellant Victor Wright.
All right. Well, if you're prepared to proceed.
I am.
May it please the court, counsel, the issue before the court in this matter is whether or not the harassment restraining order statute permits a district court judge to impose firearm surrender orders or and or firearm prohibitions as part of an HRO. And appellant's position, based squarely on the statute, is that such orders are not permitted and that the HRO statute forms the boundary of a district court's jurisdiction because a HRO is a creature of statute, not unlike an order for protection, which has its own separate statute. And the remedies, if you want to call them that, or the orders that are permitted by the HRO statute simply do not include firearm surrender or firearm prohibition orders. And as such, the district court's order that the appellant surrender his weapons and not possess any firearms is unlawful because it is outside of the district court's statutorily granted authority.
You're not asking this court to reverse the entire harassment restraining order.
No.
So we would, you know, if we were to go along with your argument, we would affirm that, but reverse and remand for vacation of the firearms provision?
That's right. I hope the district court record is clear that the motion that was made in the district court, the last motion that was made in the district court, was specifically for that relief. It was a request that the harassment restraining order be modified so as to excise or remove the firearm prohibition and firearm surrender portion, not any other part of it.
So I have just one more question. So the only issue before us, as far as you're concerned, is the district court's authority to impose that term.
The firearm prohibition and surrender order. That's right.
Okay. So, and I know you filed a motion to strike parts of an addendum, parts of a brief. Do any of the materials you seek to strike, do any of them bear on that sole legal issue before us?
I don't think so. Although I think this comes back to the extent to which a respondent in an appeal can expand, perhaps, or redirect or alter what the issue is on appeal. And my perception of respondent's approach to the case is one of whether or not the HRO should have been ordered, not so much about whether or not the firearm prohibition and firearm surrender orders are valid. So with respect to those, the subjects of appellant's motion to strike, that would be in response to my perception of how a respondent has approached the appeal. But on the narrow issue of whether or not firearm surrender or prohibition orders are lawful, no, I don't think they do.
And Mr. Cashins, is your answer to Judge Bjorkman in terms of limited issue regarding the statutory authority the reason why you, in your brief, indicate our review is de novo? I noticed in respondent's brief there's a reference to abuse of discretion, which we normally would do when reviewing whether an HRO was properly issued, but your clarification is that it's simply a matter of statute, so that's why it's a de novo review of the statute.
That's right, Judge. The rule is that issues of law, statutory interpretation, are issues of law, and issues of law are subject to a de novo review, and that's precisely how I see it. That's right.
Are there any other, we'll call them remedies, again, for lack of a better word, or specific orders, requirements, obligations that a court In your experience, has in an HRO ordered that go beyond what's listed in the statute? I'm just trying to get a sense for just how big a line are you asking us to draw here? And are there things that may not be related to firearms, but may be something that a court would consider in an HRO that is also not listed?
So I think the place to start, Your Honor, is with the statute, and the statute is clear that if the district court makes the requisite findings, factual findings, then it may issue, doesn't have to, but it may issue particular orders, and those orders are specified in the statute. They include essentially do not harass orders and what are sometimes called stay away orders or no contact, both in the intangible sense, like a phone call, but also in the tangible sense, as in remain 500 feet or a mile or whatever.
Does the statute include something specific to those geographic restrictions?
It doesn't. That's absolutely right. It doesn't. Probably because I think the legislature understood that there may be a case-by-case basis. Minnesota has a wide variety of jurisdictions, some very rural, some very urban, and what might work in one setting might not be appropriate in another setting.
Well, we have case law that suggests or that says that those geographical restrictions are not inappropriate because they're so closely tied to contact. And if you can, by statute, prohibit contact, then it's sort of implied that the court would have authority to then restrict those on a geographic basis and do the stay-away orders you're saying. So I guess the question I have for you is whether we should consider something that's outside the specific remedies as akin to how you're characterizing a firearms order or akin to how we have previously looked at geographic restrictions that are closely tied to contact.
I think if we start from the question of whether or not something is a stay-away order, then the extent of the stay-away order could be subject to litigation and or appeal. For example, there are cases where a stay-away order is too excessive. It's deemed banishment. And so there are limits to even stay-away orders. I don't know that I've seen a case on this, but another example I can think of would be if a district court judge were to order someone to stay away from, let's say the respondent and appellant live in the same congressional district, and the district court judge ordered that the person not vote because they might encounter the other person at the same polling place. I think that might be, that would be a dubiously legal order in my mind. Now, staying away, generally, no, because that's specifically provided by statute. But this is the problem that arises when we, in my mind, deviate from or go outside of the limitations of the statute. For example, what would restrict a district court from ordering a person to surrender their motor vehicle and to not drive, or to not go outside of their home during nighttime hours? I'm not sure how that wouldn't be, those wouldn't be lawful orders if the firearm prohibition and surrender orders in this case are upheld. It's not simply a slippery slope argument, it's a square issue of what does the statute provide for and what does it not provide for.
Mr. Cashin, how do you respond? I think in respondents' brief, they make the point that there was ample grounds in the record to support a gun prohibition. And then I think additionally, a respondent referred to the subdivision 6, I think the violation of a HRO, the felony level when one's in the possession of a firearm. How do you respond to those? And maybe you did in your reply brief. I don't remember seeing a response to that.
Thank you, Your Honor. In response to your first question about the ample grounds for the firearm order, I will note that in the transcript of the case, first, there's no reference whatsoever to a firearm in petitioner's petition. There's no allegation of any conduct involving a firearm, using, carrying, et cetera, in petitioner's petition, which is what started this entire case. And there is no reference to firearms until the very end of the evidentiary hearing. There's no mention of firearms until the very end when the district court is, I'm going to paraphrase it this way, is essentially asking Mr. Wright, appellant, some sort of a series of sort of background questions or sort of what's your life situation. And
what difference does that make if, as you assert, this particular form of relief is simply not available under the terms of the harassment restraining order statute? So what difference does it make that there was or wasn't a gun in this case?
In my view, it doesn't. But if we are going, if the idea is that it could be lawful, then I think then the next thing I would say is that there must be some connection between the order and the conduct giving rise to the order. And so this appears to be a case where it is a case where it simply by dint of my client being a lawful firearm owner, that is what brought him within the sights, no pun intended, of the district court in terms of whether to issue a firearm surrender order. I would never counsel a client to lie, but I didn't represent Mr. Wright in this case, but I don't think we would be here if Mr. Wright had simply said, no, I don't own firearms. So there's no discussion of or allegation of any connection between the firearm prohibition or firearm surrender order. With regard to your second question, forgive me, but what was the second part of your?
Well, there was reference made to the subdivision 6, the repeat violation, felony level or violation of an HR when in possession of a firearm. But if I understood your answer to Judge Bjorkman's question, which is part of why I asked the question in the first place, your main point is that none of that's relevant to our analysis de novo because we're simply asked, did the court have authority at all to prohibit the firearms by the HRO?
That's right. I will say, though, that if we were to take the position that it's that it could be lawful, let's put it that way. The other problem that a firearm prohibition or firearm surrender order creates in the face of the statutory scheme is that there is a prohibition, there's a crime, it is a crime, for a person to violate an HRO while in possession of a firearm, and that's a felony level offense. And that's a crime, quite obviously, I think, because the legislature wants to make sure to dissuade people from using a firearm as part of an HRO violation, i.e. going up to the person who has the order against them while possessing a firearm.
I thought the statute talks about dangerous weapon, which is not the same. I mean, a firearm is a dangerous weapon. It's not the only dangerous weapon.
You're right. I'm sorry, Judge. That's absolutely right. It does say dangerous weapon, and I would say that does include a firearm. Yeah. And so it would render the misdemeanor offense of HRO violation essentially a nullity if a firearm prohibition or firearm surrender order can be made part of a district court HRO, because then merely by possessing or owning a firearm, a person's in violation. And then we've jumped immediately to the dangerous weapon felony level offense. And even though that person had no contact with the protected person, the person's automatically under this scheme has potential felony criminal liability for owning a firearm while having an HRO against them if firearm prohibition, firearm surrender orders are lawful. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
And I can't remember if I can reserve time or not, but.
Yes, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
And I'll yield my remaining minute.
Good morning. Patrick Boley on behalf of the respondent, Kristen Egan. At the outset, I want to alert the court to one authority that was not cited in either the briefs or either side's briefs, and that's the Minnesota Gun Control Statute, Section 624.713, which discusses persons ineligible to possess firearms. There, under Subdivision 111, it precludes people from possessing weapons for 3 years after a criminal conviction of harassment or stalking under 609.749. Now, there's an argument that could be made that the legislature intended by that statute to be the definitive word on when a person can be deprived of firearms, and that only if the requirements of the statute are met does a court have authority to make such a ruling. I want to be clear, that's not my interpretation. That's not how I read the statute. The statute does not say, for example, that its list of people prevented from carrying firearms is the only list. And that courts are somehow deprived of jurisdiction from making orders in other contexts. But I want to make sure that statute is at least in front of the court as we proceed before with our discussion. In this case, and it's relevant too, because in this case the parties are battling over what the appropriate standard of review is.
And can I just clarify first, yeah. Mr. Bulley, what you're referring to is if one is, which isn't our situation, if one is convicted of a gross misdemeanor level of a violation of a HRO, your point, then they would be prohibited.
Exactly.
Now, and how does that tie into an initial HRO like we have here?
Well, the only point I'm trying to make is that there is the statute out there called the Gun Control Statute, and because that statute specifically enumerates a, you know, misdemeanor violation of the harassment or stalking restraining order, that in that instance that person is obligated to cough up their weapons for 3 years. You could argue, I'm not arguing it, but I want to make sure it's in front of the court, that that type of provision might be deemed to preclude the court in this instance from issuing the order that it issued. Again, it's not my argument, but that's why I reference it for the court. And I think actually you can look at numerous examples out there, and the most obvious one would be in cases where a person has been arrested for a crime and charged with it, and now we're looking at bail. It's frequently the case that judges will order the relinquishment of firearms pending trial on that in that case. And while that situation is referenced in the statute, it's not, the statute is silent one way or the other on whether judges have that authority. And so the fact that it's silent there suggests to me that it's silent in other instances as well. And ultimately, kind of to the court's point, and I'll return to this in a few minutes, we're looking at an injunctive relief statute, plain and simple. And while, you know, appellant wants to say that this is an issue of law and that you look only at the statute, my point is that the statute, by its very nature, is quite broad, and it's designed to encompass a wide, wide variety of situations, and that it can't possibly anticipate, as Justice Bryan has noted, time and distance restrictions or other types of restrictions that in particular cases may not be authorized, but if you have the right facts, they are.
And can I ask you about that? Because I've been thinking along these lines, and as you acknowledge and discussed in appellant's argument, to the extent that the appellate courts have affirmed HROs that go beyond simply saying don't harass and don't have contact, but include such things as distance or time provisions, it seems like those additional components, if you will, of the HRO have been tied to one of the two expressly identified things that a HRO can contain. And so my question is, how on the facts of this case does a firearms restriction flow from one of those two?
Right, and so if you look at the statute, there's a provision that refers to ceasing and avoiding harassment of another person. And in this case, we had very strong factual findings that my client was being stalked. And I know appellant in his reply brief fights that term, but that's the term that Judge Carter used in his December 8 order, was that she was being stalked. And so...
But not in the terms of a criminal stalking offense.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Okay. But the concept of appellant's appeal is that the court can see that in an HRO hearing and is helpless to do anything about it. And I respectfully submit that that cannot be the law, that we see these headlines all the time about people going off the edge, about people with guns going after and murdering employees or co-workers, women that they wanted to have relationships with, and it just didn't work out for them. And here we have a situation where Judge Carter himself in his order is saying, this is really troubling, and this guy's admitted to problems with alcohol, et cetera, et cetera. And for my client, a distance restriction doesn't necessarily cut it, in part because her testimony at the hearing says that after the temporary restraining order is issued, she spots him out in the outside the parking lot of the Lunds and Byerly's where she works, and he's marching back and forth, carrying a backpack, by the way. And I want to put a pin in that and come back to that in a minute. But the point is that there's having already seen him violate a distance restriction on a temporary harassment restraining order, and having that in front of the court, the judge is now looking at a situation where, first, what's your remedy in order to make sure that something doesn't escalate here? And secondly, what's your remedy that can give my client any kind of peace of mind as she goes forward in the world? She's living in fear. She's talking about, you know, losing sleep and, you know, changing how she goes to her car every night and making sure she's parking her car in different places. And so how do you fix that situation? And I will agree.
Can I ask you, I appreciate those comments, but would it be fair to characterize those as reasonable policy arguments that across the street the legislature ought to be made in terms of authority? But this is a special proceeding set by statute, unlike a common law injunction you made reference to. Aren't we limited to paragraph 5A1-2 in terms of our de novo review of what's authorized?
Well, and that goes to Justice Bryan's questions a moment ago about is this the only remedy here? My client is getting harassed. She's initially starts this action pro se. She files a harassment restraining order, likely because she contacted someone at Dakota County in the district court, and they told her that's how you do it. And she fills out the forms that they have for her, and she shows up and she makes that argument. And you can see Judge Carter on the other side of this thing. Same deal. He has all this evidence in front of him. He knows that he's got an issue in order right away. And so he's just checking the boxes on the HRO form. But whether he would do that, whether she would plead it that way, whether or not we're seeking broader injunctive relief under Civil Rule 6501, which has also been found in the Baker decision cited in my brief as something that would certainly authorize other remedies in a domestic abuse context and is a statute that goes hand in hand with something like the HRO statute. That's my point, is the appellant wants to put us in that little silo. And my point is first of all, that silo isn't so small as it looks. I had a case a couple years ago where the offending contact was grandma and grandpa showing up with Christmas presents on Christmas Eve for the grandkids. And you might look at that and say, well, as a matter of law, that can't possibly be what the HRO statute is all about. Well, listen to the facts further. And ultimately, the court in that case found that there was cause for issuing a harassment restraining order.
Well, if I could jump in here, because I don't want to get too far afield. The question that Judge Bjorkman asked you was, how do you tie firearms to one of the two very, the two express, we'll call them remedies again.
Right.
No contact, no harassment. And it seemed like you were starting to talk about the facts here about stalking. I was expecting you to then tie firearms to stalking, but it didn't seem like we got to that point. And now, right. Now I wonder if your argument is actually different. And going back to something you said at the outset, that under this injunctive remedy or injunctive relief, that there is some broad authority for a district court to order all kinds of things at the HRO stage. Your answer is it doesn't have to be tied. Are you trying to tie it to something, or are you saying that it doesn't have to be tied
I'm saying both.
But maybe we can get back to
I'm saying this court can affirm the decision on any one of a variety of grounds. And if you're looking to tie it to the statute, I would say that if you look under the restraining order that can be issued, which involves ceasing or avoiding harassment of a person, in this case, where ceasing and avoiding harassment of a person necessarily involves removing the fear that that person has, and it's a particularly keen fear in light of how the respondent very reasonably has interpreted the situation and has escalated fears in light of a violation of a temporary restraining order in terms of distance
any
requirements.
Any indication in the record that there's some fear related to firearms?
Right, and so
I'm just asking, and yeah, I don't mean to put you on the spot, nope. Because if there isn't any, then you can just say that, and maybe that's a distinguishing point that doesn't help you out, but I'm
just... Nope, I'm happy to answer the question. And the answer is, in the record, no. If this court is not satisfied with the record on appeal and has any reason to accept any part of appellant's arguments, then I would ask for a remand on this issue. And I ask that in particular because the way in which the evidentiary hearing went down in this case was a little bit unusual. If you read the transcript, and I'm not complaining, by the way. I think Judge Carter undertook basically examination and cross-examination of everyone involved in the case on his own and shunted Patrick Boley, attorney at law, to the side because he wanted to take the air out of the ball, basically. He wanted to take the emotion out of the proceeding. He was recognizing that this isn't going to be about pointing fingers at anyone. We're just going to try and get to answers. But in the process of that, the evidence that might have come in would have included the fact that my client had seen respondent put in his backpack on multiple occasions firearms, and that when she sees him violating the temporary restraining order and marching back and forth on the perimeter of the Lunds and Byerly's parking lot, and he's carrying that camouflage backpack with him, she had a reasonable surmise that there were firearms in that backpack, and that added to the fear. Admittedly, that was never in the record, and so we're, you know, I think, frankly, it almost goes to how serious Judge Carter's concerns were about the appellant's demeanor at the hearing, because he was legitimately concerned about what he thought was a troubling respondent in this case.
Mr. Bullock, can I ask you, by that reasoning, and it looked like from the facts that there was a lot of text messages sent. By that reasoning that you're arguing that to prevent further harassment and the reasonable fear that was found, and I assume that's why the HRO itself is not being contested, would not the court have authority then under the statute to prohibit him from turn over this phone and prohibit him from using a phone?
On some levels, that argument follows logically. I think the critical distinctive factor here is that firearms are inherently dangerous, whereas appellant can use his phone in a wide variety of circumstances without any problem. And in the event that he ever used his phone to send a text message, my client would have evidence that she could immediately take to the police without necessarily being killed in the process. So I think that would be the distinction there. But it goes to the broader point, which is that there are a wide variety of circumstances that don't necessarily match up perfectly with the statute, but where this court has repeatedly found that the court had discretion to do what it did. And this is one of them. There were all kinds of reasons to be concerned for my client, and the court should not be rendered handicapped or have his hands tied in knowing that we have a potentially explosive situation and knowing that my client is in danger. And the crazy thing I see when I read appellant's brief is that, you know, the implication seems to be if she had just had a relationship with this guy, she would have fallen under the domestic abuse statute and we wouldn't be here on appeal.
Mr. Boley, before, I don't want to, again, go too far afield, but there is... some argument, I think, that it, at some stage could be made comparing the specific relief in the order for protection statute versus the specific relief in the HRO statute. But I believe that in order to get there, we'd have to first address ambiguity. And I don't see you arguing in your brief that this is an ambiguous statute. Is that correct? Are you arguing ambiguity?
I'm arguing that this is a broad statute, and certainly there can be ambiguity in the statute. I don't know how this statute can possibly be interpreted the way this court has interpreted over the years without recognizing that it is broad, that it is injunctive, and
breadth
that the statute
is a little different than subject to multiple interpretations. So if you're arguing it's ambiguous, where in your brief do you make that argument?
I don't make the argument in the brief, but I would submit to you that the provision that says cease or avoid the harassment of another person, you can call it ambiguous. I would say it's incredibly broad, and that if having a gun after engaging in stalking conduct, having the very fact of having a gun would reasonably put a petitioner in fear, and that the petitioner would be authorized under the statute to obtain an order depriving the respondent in that instance of his firearms. I see that I'm out of time. I would like to just make one final point, if I may.
Go ahead.
And that is, it seems to me that there's a threshold question, and it goes to what Judge Bjorkman started with at the outset of appellant's oral argument, and that is the question of the matters in the appendices. And I will say there's two quick points. One is that one of the things that's included in the appendix was a letter that my client wrote to the court. Almost everything in the brief factually is supported by reference to the transcript. So regardless of whether this court keeps that letter in or out, should be of no moment. With regard to the other item in the appendix, that has to do with the Burnsville police protocols. And I think it's an important point that this court needs to consider, because I actually think that we get to the end of my oral argument and I haven't stated the threshold question here, which is that when you read appellant's brief at page 4, he appears to be making pretty clear, and he never responds to my invitation in my response, he appears to be making pretty clear that his client has not complied with the firearm component of the order, and he has not sought a stay of that order on appeal. So my question to the court, and I encourage you to ask him when he comes up on his reply, is how is it that he's seeking relief from this court and thinks the court should respect his appeal if he's not respecting the additional, existing order, and he hasn't sought any kind of leave to have that stayed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bowley. Rebuttal, Mr. Cashins.
Sorry, I realized I sat at the wrong table there.
It threw me off at the beginning,
yeah,
but
sorry.
I think we clarified pretty quickly.
I didn't see it until I was just sitting.
Fine.
I'd like to return for a moment to something Judge Bjorkman essentially asked, and I think all of the judges have asked, and that is, are we dealing with the statute or aren't we? And I will point out that there are documents in the record, of course, and petitioner's petition says on the first page, it invokes the statute, 609.748, the temporary order that was issued is an order under 609.748. The order after the hearing, also 609.748. So I don't think there's any plausible argument that we are not anywhere but under that statute, the harassment restraining order statute. I agree that in the abstract that harassment restraining orders like orders for protection are legally what you would describe as injunctive relief. They're not judgments for money damages, of course, but that doesn't mean then that any or all of the rules that would apply to temporary injunctions or permanent injunctions suddenly then become applicable to harassment restraining order actions or order for protection actions. There are a wide variety of other procedures that would apply, and that's that don't apply to an HRO, and that's why the HRO statute is as long as it is, because it gets down to the level of when you have hearings and what happens at those hearings. It's not everything, of course. There are other court rules that still apply, but this is not a situation where an HRO, the rules regarding an HRO are suddenly include any case law that applies perhaps to an injunction. And that really gets to a notice problem, a due process issue of, well, if a person is served with a temporary HRO that comes with the petition, that's what they're on notice of. And there is nothing putting my client or any other person who receives an HRO of the type in with the substance of those papers in this case that their firearms are in any way at issue. There's nothing in the temporary restraining order regarding firearms. And so this issue of firearms doesn't come up until, I want to say, the last like three pages or so of the hearing transcript. It's very much at the end. The other point I wanted to make was that the order for protection statute provides, I think, a helpful comparative device in that the Minnesota legislature plainly knows how to restrict, impact, control.
And but if there's not an argument about ambiguity, then is it proper statutory interpretation to get to that, I'll call it a canon?
No, right, there is not. If the statute is clear on its face, then there is no construction that needs to be required. That there is a difference. We frequently get it wrong, but there is a difference between interpretation and construction. And where the letter of the law is clear, you have to read it first. I have to understand what it says. But if there is no question about what it says, then there is no cause for or opportunity for construing it. That's right.
Can I ask you this? We've talked this morning about the fact that the courts, that our appellate courts have affirmed HROs that go beyond simply, you know, enjoining harassment or contact by saying you can't be within X miles of this person or on these hours or this person's place of work. What is it about the firearm prohibition when we have a broad definition of harassment that includes incidents of physical and sexual assault? What is it about the firearms that would be a bridge too far in terms of enforcing, if you will, the two statutory components?
Your Honor, I don't really think there are too many cases that go beyond the letter of the law, and the distance prohibitions, I believe, fall squarely under subdivision 5A2, orders the respondent to have no contact. I think there are differing ways that no contact can be achieved. One could be distance, one could be don't call this person, don't mail letters to this person, another one could be don't physically visit this person or come within some distance of them. But I think those fall squarely under it. The case of Rohr versus Dunham makes clear that the statutory language is important. In fact, it is all important. In that case, an extension of the underlying HR, the initial HRO, was struck down because the statute doesn't permit it. And thus the court has returned to the idea, as it should, that the statutory language controls. And I see that my time is up. But of course, if you have questions, I'll.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I know that there are some people, well, let me first say thank you for your arguments. We will, the matter is now received, and we will issue an opinion within the statutory time frame.